My guys, I prefer wine. So, very commonly, and certainly for me personally, when it comes to a shmooze, we like to relate it to Inyan HaDiyon as much as possible. Make it relevant to the time period. So, what am I talking about? Chayisar. No, Thanksgiving. It's true. Thanksgiving is the topic. Now, before we can begin to evaluate Thanksgiving, we need a little bit of the history, which hopefully everybody's familiar with. When was the first Thanksgiving? 1621, right? What was the first Thanksgiving about? All right. We'll assume that we're going to brush up on our American history. Right? The Mayflower, the Pilgrims, Plymouth. What happened, there was a particularly, the details are important here, I'm not just fooling around. There was a very harsh winter, and because of this harsh winter, the expectation was that they were going to starve. And lo and behold, b'siyata d'shraya, they had plenty of food, enough not only for the pilgrims, but even to share it with the Indians. Everyone always remembers that part. Good. Indians. So they had the very first Thanksgiving in 1621. And then every year since? No. After the excitement of that first great harvest that resulted in this great Yeshua, the excitement died down, right? They certainly felt the need for Hakaras HaTov after the first event, but then that was it for about 150 years. 150 years later, who was it that declared the first national Thanksgiving in 1789? President George Washington. Very good. George Washington. What was his inspiration? Why did George Washington do this? He said, whoa, we just did an amazing thing. We won the Revolutionary War, right? We established a democracy. It's an incredible, this is not a joke. This is an incredible event. That's a very significant inspiration. And if anyone is into these things, George Washington's speech, when he declared this national Thanksgiving holiday at the end of November, right, just like we have it, it's a very religious statement. This is almost part of the halachic problem that arises, Bizmanenu, but he saw it as a time to give thanks through a sudas hadah, you know, lahavdil, not a halachic sudas hadah, but a real celebration to give thanks to the Almighty who gave them democracy and gave them this victory. Did it catch on then? No. The problem was two things. One, after the country kind of settled in, so the excitement, the original excitement of that great Yeshua died down. And in addition, Thomas Jefferson, everyone heard of him? So he was bothered by the religious implications. He's a big separation of church and state guy. Right? Nothing changes, right? We still got guys like that running around, causing trouble. But never happened. No Thanksgiving until about 70 years later when President 1863? Abraham Lincoln was the one who established Thanksgiving that we celebrate to this day. What was his inspiration? President Lincoln was inspired by, right, the end of slavery. It was sort of in the middle of the Civil War. It ended in 1865. But he also saw it as a great momentous time in history, a time to give thanks. And that one stuck. That one stuck. So there are many halachic issues that arise from Thanksgiving. Maybe at Mishmar it'll be discussed. You know, issues of Bechuk Hoseim Lo Seilechu, about us celebrating Thanksgiving, or not to be Mesayeya Le'ovdei Avodah Zarah. If there's any religious implications to what they're doing, and it's Avodah Zarah, which the Rambam, for example, held certainly Christianity is, then that's a big problem to participate in such things. There's many tshuvas written on this. Rav Moshe, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Huttner, Rav Menashe Klein. There's a whole sort of literature on this in the poskim. But I don't want to talk about any. Right? We're not going to talk about the halachic implications. Right? Anyone who wants to afterwards, I'd be very happy to. It's very interesting. Right? I'll tell you the mice, it's mutter. Right? Just in case anyone's getting nervous. Right? Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's mutter, mainly because it's considered a secular holiday, bizmanenu. It's not considered anything religious. You should stay away from any party that's going to be making it a religious event. a non-Jewish religious event, you have to stay away from that. But the secular mode, you know, ever since Roosevelt shifted Thanksgiving because he wanted to increase shopping, it was clearly a secular mercantile day, not a religious day. So it's mutter to do, but there's something else I wanted to focus on. And that is the hashkafic discussion that comes out of Thanksgiving. What is it? It usually goes something like this. And the same type of hashkafic statement is made by Mother's Day and Father's Day. We kind of pat ourselves on the shoulder or the back, and we say, look at them. What was the thing that inspired Thanksgiving? It was always some major event. It had to be a big issue of the Revolutionary War, democracy, the Civil War, end of slavery. It's always got to be, the big harvest after the harsh winter, something big. And therefore they'll have a day of Thanksgiving. But our hashkafa and halacha, as we'll see in a moment, pushes something very different. It's not just the big events that are reason for Hakaras HaTov. We have a daily, right? A daily requirement of Hakaras HaTov. It's something that, let's say, the whole institution of Birchas Shevach V'Hodaya is really built on that idea. Many, many brachos is because we need to be mindful of all the things that we need to be grateful for. So this is one we got over them for sure. You know, they have like Thanksgiving. It's a very nice thing. But hashkafically, aren't we much, much more accomplished in looking at the everyday common events that we go through as a reason for Hakaras HaTov? The other thing is, Hakaras HaTov is so significant for us, and this we're going to need to explain. There is a famous Medrash Rabbah that says, La'asid lavo, all the korbanos are going to be bato, chutz mi the korban todah. The korban todah is going to be the one korban, the Yemosa Mashiach, after the Geula, that one's not bato. Obviously, todah and giving Hakaras HaTov is very significant to Yadus. So we need to understand it. Now, the truth of the matter is, as much as we are very, very proud of the fact that we have this emphasis of Hakaras HaTov all the time, if we're honest with ourselves, while in the ideal, the halacha describes this, really, for most of us, it's not so passionate, right? We're human. We know that it's not so simple to always feel gratitude for these simple things. We go to sleep, we wake up, we breathe, we talk, we see, we think, we feel, we touch. We're able to do all those things, but of course we're human. What's the big deal? Why do I have to feel Hakaras HaTov for all that? It's a very natural thing not to feel that way. Certainly, when something big happens, where there's a Yeshua, I'm about to die and I get saved, or there's some, you know, lo aleinu, some calamitous event, and I get saved, I'll make a Seudas Hodaah, I'll be dropping right in there. But not so commonly do we all feel that Hakaras HaTov for the simple things of getting up and walking and talking, and being able to see, and all those things that we really should. And in fact, this dichotomy, which we were making fun of them a moment ago, where I was, that we ourselves need to work on, expresses itself in the halacha. Halacha is very aware of this. And the halacha, in the one I saw, a beautiful hakdama to Hilchos Brachos by Piskei Tshuvos, by Simon, by the Birchas HaGomel, Simon Reish Yutes. And over there he describes two categories of brachos. There's brachos Shevach V'Hodaya, or really Birchas Shevach, and then there's Birchas Plain Hodah. What's Birchas Shevach V'Hodaya? Those are those brachos that are the every common day ones. Asher Yotzer, Hamapil, the Birchas Re'iyah, all the Birchas HaShachar, all those brachos we make on all those things that we're referring to that are the common everyday things we should be grateful for. And then, the Birchas straight Hodah is a completely different category. That's the bracha of Birchas HaGomer and Shechayanu for a new fruit or for a baby or Baruch HaTov HaMeiti. That's a completely different category. What's the nafkamina between the categories? Very, very significant, and it expresses the idea we were just talking about. The brachos that are the brachos for every day, for all the day-to-day things that Hashem gives us, the gifts that we should be grateful for, Asher Yatzer, etc., they're chiyuvim. The bracha is a bracha that's a chiyuv. But the bracha, Birchas HaGomel and Shechayanu, Rishus, They're not chiyuvos. Why would this be? Why are those something that were chayavim? And afilu noshim and tanim are chayavim. But when it comes to birchas agomel, it's called rishus, and it's called not necessarily something I'm chayavim. And noshim and tanim, no. Debate about noshim, ketanim certainly no. Why? So it has to do with this exact idea that the halacha recognizes that people are much more likely to take those brachos, the birchos shevach v'hodaya, for granted. They're going to not think that they need to make a bracha pokeach ivrim. They're not going to really feel that hakaras hatov. So it's chiyuvis. But the brachos for big events, you know, something, the arba tzrichim lahodos, those kind of things, of course, that's going to be more natural. It'll be rishus, right? So it's more dependable. But it's not only that. The Achronim say it had to be rishus. It has to be rishus because for those brachas to work, the bracha on the birchas agomel, for example, a bracha on a Yeshua where somebody gets something really good happens to them and they're saved, their life is saved, they're safe from danger, they go over dangerous territory and they're okay, all that is something that has chalos, it has meaning, only if it's coming from you voluntarily. If it's imposed on you, what kind of expression of gratitude is that? It's got to be something that's like welling up within you. I feel it. I feel it. The way they say it, is as follows. This kind of bracha is something that requires simcha salev, hadavar hatole bidei kol echa ve'echa. It's something that requires a real simcha salev, not a phony simcha salev, but a genuine one, a spontaneous one. And that's going to be totally in every person. If they experience it, they will. If they don't, they don't. The other brachos are very, very significant. They're chayuvis. For example, it's very interesting. The Machaber does something he doesn't do anywhere else in the Shulchan Aruch. When it comes to what kind of sefer is the Shulchan Aruch? It's the sefer halacha. It's psak din. It's the final word. He doesn't give perushim there generally. But if you look at, let's say, the bracha of Asher Yotzer, that bracha he felt was so important that a person have hakaras hatov for the bodily functions that we have, that the Mechaber writes, here's going to be, as this koteris, as the title, Dine Asher Yotzer Velokai Neshama Uperushav. And then he goes on, in the Shulchan Aruch, way out of character, suddenly, to explain in great depth many different opinions of different Rishonim, so that he makes sure everybody appreciates that this bracha is real and something that you have to understand. This has to be something that you have to kind of impose on people because it's not a natural thing to do. But the other type, the birchas agomel, that, of course, a person is going to be more likely to feel it, and therefore it's going to be something that we can count on them having it as rishus, spontaneous, and it'll come to them. So we're great, right? What a nice religion. It seems like we got it covered, right? In summary, we have these two types of brachos. They reflect human nature very, very, very accurately. The things we would neglect, we're chayav to do them. We're going to make sure we understand them. The things that are coming from rishus, we're dependable. We're likely to have these spontaneous reactions, and everything's fantastic. So, I thought, and then an event happened, and if Rabbi Olshin was here, he'd be saying, oh, here comes another one of Rabbi Apfel's doctor stories. And he'd be right. Something happened in the world of medical care that just blew me away and revamped my entire understanding of everything we've been talking about. And I'll explain. Remember, the premise is that everybody, does anyone disagree with this? Something, if you're saved, if your life is saved, you're going to feel hakaras hatov. So there was this young man who was a patient of mine for many, many years. And he had very, very difficult disease, and he was kind of like making his way through the years. And then it came to a point where he had two options. Not do anything in it, and he really didn't have much longer to live. Or do this operation that was incredibly high risk. It could kill him on the spot, or give him a much fuller life. So a lot of medical opinions were sought. Rav Chaim Kanievsky, Rav Dan Siegel, right? Rav Steinemann, and maybe even a few MDs, right? All these people were asked, what should we do? The son, he was the son of a Rosh Yeshiva. That's why he was getting all those opinions. And the consensus opinion was definitely, go ahead, do the surgery. Go for it, right? There's a principle. I remember, because I was zochet to ask these gedolim, the shiloh for the family. So when I went to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, you know, he doesn't speak much, right? Because he doesn't want to waste his words on anything but Torah. He said to me, I asked him the shiloh, he says, Achiezer, Chelek Yimbal, whatever simon, I don't remember the exact simon, he did, but I don't. Which is referring to this principle of, when it comes to Chaye Olam, the opportunity to have a full life, Lo Chay Shina No Chay Shah. We're not going to worry about it. That's all over time. He said that, go, right? So we did it. And I remember biting my nails thinking, oh my God, I pushed this forward also. I really wanted them to go for it. And Baruch Hashem, unbelievable. The biggest Yeshua, one of the biggest Yeshuas of my entire career. His life was saved. Mamish saved, right? I don't want to give any hints, but recently he just got engaged. I mean, it's an amazing Yeshua. So the family, as you would expect, were jubilant. They were excited. They were happy. Wow, this is fantastic. We got to make a Sudas Hoga. And they wanted me to tell them, when is it completely out of the woods? Give me the date. Because as soon as we have the date, we're going to like designate that as the date for the anniversary for the Sudas Hoga. We're going to have a Sudas Hoga year after year after year. This is going to be unbelievable. I'm getting into the excitement too. This is fantastic. I can't wait to go to the Sudas Hoga. I've got to fight the doctor, right? I'm going, right? So they come in for follow-up, and I'm like all excited, right? So what's going on with Sudas Hoga? You're making plans, and no response. What's the matter? No Sudas Hoga. What? No Sudas Hoga. Why not? It's his life. He's going to die. Mommy starts crying. The father says, it's not us. And he goes like this, which means it's him. Now, doctors don't normally get involved in this type of private family matter, but that's the advantage of being a Rebbe. Also, I was not going to hold back. I got to talk to this kid. Is he out of his mind? How could he not realize the significance, the Sutta Soda, the Akara Soto, his life is saved. So I go in, and I start to talk to him, and I say, how you doing? How you doing? Not much speaking, and I finally said, I hear you don't want to have the Sutta Soda. No Sutta Soda. I go, why not? Do you realize how close you were to dying? I thought I'd go with that approach. Do you realize that I really didn't think you were going to make it? You had a 90% chance of dying, and Hashem saved you. He's starting to get angry. Just leave me alone. I said, come on. This is such a great opportunity to show Hakar Satan. Screamed at me. He says, I don't know if he said he probably wasn't using such nice language, but he just told me to be quiet in a very loud and other word way. And he said, be quiet! You want me to be grateful? What do I have to be grateful about? And I'm thinking, your life was just saved. Most people would be very grateful. He says, you want to know what I would have been grateful for? If I was never sick in the first place. That's what I would have been grateful. Why did I have to go through this? So, oh. Whoa, wow. Whereas Rabbi Willie would say, ooh. I was blown away. What? He had a good point. No? But I think he's wrong. That argument is incorrect. And I needed to explain it to him. So you're making a big mistake. I know that, yes, it does make sense that your best thing for you would have been never to have been sick in the first place. But you were, and you were saved. There's still very strong reason why you should be very grateful. But before I had a chance to explain it, and I haven't explained it yet, just saying what I said now does not explain it. He blew me away one step further that I just didn't know what to say. He says like this. He says, and I'll tell you the truth, before you say anything else, why do I need to be happy about being alive altogether? What's the meaning of it? Why do I have to be happy? I'd be better off dead. Why do I have to be alive? Wow. That's already scary, right? Now, clearly, he was suffering from clinical depression. And there was no way I was going to respond to him just then and there. But a while later, after some good medication and therapy, I went back to him. And I said, let's go over this again. And the schmooze is really about my response to him and the two very significant challenges that he gave me. Challenge number one was this idea that you don't have to have hakaras hatov for being saved from something you would have been really better off without having to happen in the first place. It makes a lot of sense at first glance, but there's a very strong argument against it. And the second challenge, which is now makes that one look like a cream puff, is what is the meaning of life? That's a challenge, right? I have to explain to him the meaning of life. Now, I promised Chad that I would do it, and I'm going to do it. The good news is, Chad wants to know the meaning of life, right? We all do. What's the meaning of life? The good news is that it occurred to me, after I sat down and thought about it a lot, how I would talk to him, that the two challenges, haba hatalia, that you answer the second one and you got the first. If I can explain the meaning of life, mimela, I'm going to have an answer to that first taina he had, which was a very strong one. You want me to make a suda soda? I would have made a suda soda if I was healthy. But for me to get sick and then get a Yeshua, I don't want to make a suda soda. So, how do I approach this problem of the meaning of life? Now, the truth of the matter is, let's differentiate. Last year I spoke about what is real life, right? There was a question about what do we mean by real life, going back to the States, being in yeshiva, right? And what I focused on was defining real life. This is a very different question, right? Real life is the experience that a person has wherever they are, and are viewing life through the prism of Torah. That's what we spoke about. Now we're talking about something much, much more significant. What is the meaning of day-to-day life? What does life mean? This, by the way, was not the first time this question has been asked, right? This kid, who asked this just a few years ago, he's not the first person to ask this question. There is, in fact, a whole school of philosophy called existentialism. The existentialist philosophers who have been dealing with this for a very long time. In fact, you know what an existentialist philosopher is? It's a guy who makes his living discussing the meaning of life, right? Talk about having to get a life, right? But that's what they do. And there are many Jewish ones and there are non-Jewish ones. You know, Rav Soloveitchik was an existentialist to some degree. But the existentialist philosophers have asked this question: what is the meaning of life? Now you would think that a Yiras Shamayim, a person who believes in Hashem, who believes in the Torah, believes in our Masorah, is going to have nothing in common with an approach to the meaning of life with an existentialist secular philosophy. You have to realize that secular existentialists, for the most part, are atheists. They're trying to remove religion from the entire discussion. But the truth is, the starting point for the answer to what is the meaning of life, the Phineas Daiti, we share in common with that, and I'll explain what I mean. There was a famous French existentialist by the name of Albert Camus. Anyone ever hear of him? Anyone at all? We got one person who reads philosophy. Okay, good. Albert Camus wrote an interesting book. It was called The Myth of Sisyphus. Everyone know who Sisyphus was? We're getting a lot of education today. We're going from American history to Greek mythology to philosophy. But Sisyphus was this Greek myth about this guy, right? Schnook comes to mind when you think about this poor guy. What did he do? He got the gods mad at him, the quote-unquote gods mad at him, because he put Hades, who's the god of death, he locked them up. He did all sorts of things. He was outsmarting them. They finally got the best of him. And his sentence was, he would have to take this gigantic boulder, roll it up a mountain, every day, watch it come down, and start again. Pretty miserable life, right? Pretty miserable. So comes along Albert Camus, the existentialist, and he's going to use Sisyphus as his vehicle to teach us about the meaning of life. And he opens up the book with the following quote. "There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living. Whether or not the world has three dimensions or the mind, 9 or 12 categories, or other studies of academic interest, only come later. You can ponder this or analyze that aspect of the universe, but the real question, the only one that counts first and foremost, is life worth living?" Very interesting. So he says, nothing's more important for a human being to settle than our question. Is life worth living? What is the meaning of life? What is it all about? Any other endeavor to understand the universe or explore it, he thinks is secondary. So he has an answer to this, by the way, which we'll get to. But before we do we accept that premise? Is it true that you have to first answer the question, what is the meaning of life? And only then, after, start exploring and understanding the universe and what the universe is about? Does that make sense? Absolutely not. And I want to just quote somebody who really, he's a secular professor, but he's going to say something that I think is very, very, going to be very, very meaningful to us. His name is Dr. Brian Greene. Anyone ever hear of him? So he is a physics professor at Columbia, and very brilliant. He was a Rhodes Scholar. He's one of these Renaissance people. He does it all, right? Great athlete, brilliant math, physics professor. He knows everything. And he comes in and he tells that he read Camus and thinks Camus made a very big mistake. And I'll just quote from his book. The book is called The Fabric of the Cosmos. Anyone interested in cosmology, I highly recommend it. "Camus acknowledged value in understanding the structure of the universe, but rejected the possibility that such understanding could make any difference to our assessment of life's worth. To this aspiring physicist," talking about himself, "it seemed that an informed appraisal of life absolutely required a full understanding of life's arena, the universe. By deepening our understanding of the nature of the physical reality, we will profoundly reconfigure our sense of ourselves and our experience of the universe." Everyone understand what he's saying? What he's saying makes incredibly good sense. He's saying, you want to talk about the value of life and what life means? How could you do that before you really understand fully, to the best of your abilities, what life is? You have to know as much as you can. Just to really draw this out, imagine your perception of life and the world when you were 5 years old. Has it changed now that you're 18? It should. I hope it did. Right? The way you view life and the way you see the world, it has to have changed. It can't be that your assessment of the value of life as a five-year-old would be the same. Or how about this? Before and after Shana Aleph, is your assessment of life the same before Shana Aleph as it is after? Clearly not. A person can't begin to talk about the meaning of life until they have a real good foundation and understanding of life. And that's why Dr. Greene rejects Camus. He said, Camus, that second point, that we should just figure out the meaning of life devoid of other understandings of the universe, is ridiculous. But Dr. Greene wasn't the first one to say this. Our Masoret said it many centuries earlier. And Chovas HaLevavos says the exact same idea. The understanding of the fine and subtle parts of life is not going to be the same by somebody whose ability to recognize things is weak. It's going to be a very different endeavor for somebody whose ability to recognize things is stronger. Al kein al tanuach dascha al mashi hitzdayer belibcha betchilas limudecha biyemei neurecha. Therefore, a person should never ever rest on their assumptions about life that they drew when they were young, inexperienced, not knowing anything, like my friend the sick patient and assume that your experience and your knowledge and your take on life in the world will be the same once you have matured, acquired more understanding and more knowledge. It's Yesod that the Chovas Levavos is said many centuries before Brian Greene was ever born, that is elementary. And so this we share in common with the modern existentialist like Brian Greene, if he wants to call himself that, I doubt he does. But what we share with them is this idea, not like Camus. First and foremost, before we could talk about what life is, we need absolutely to understand it to its fullest extent as a mature, knowledgeable person. So now Greene is worried about not thinking the world runs like Isaac Newton said, but realizing that Albert Einstein introduced a whole new understanding of reality. But for us, there's something else. And here's where we part ways completely with a secular philosopher. The secular philosopher is going to say, you know, I'm going to discover what life's about purely through experimentation, scientific observation, empirical data, rational thinking. But we know, especially if we understood what the real life was last year, we know that the only way to understand life, the only way to really understand life, is going to require something that's coming through nevuah, that's coming through something that is metaphysical, beyond just scientific, rational experimentation. This is something that's very much emphasized in the Drasha Saran. The Ran says this in Drasha Chamishi. He says, if you want to understand life and the meaning of it and your mission here, Chuyav Shimashech LaAdam Meito Shefa Asher Hu Lemala Min HaSechel HaNikra Shefa Nevui LaHashlim HaNefesh LeMan Teor BeOr Pnei Melech Chaim LeYaspik LeZeh Shefa Sichli Levad. You have to go way beyond common rationale. Now, it's interesting. You have to really believe that there is something out there beyond our five sense experience and common rationality. And, you know, I have to admit, I'm by nature a very rationalist thinker. And I don't jump into the mystic, the mystical. But I promised Rabbi Schneider I would share this experience because I told him about it right before he left for America. This was actually, if you don't believe me, what I'm about to tell you, that the truth of this story is on Arut Sheva and Yeshiva World News. It was all over the news sites, the following story. There was a person from Yerushalayim who called me up. He wanted me to take a look at a ultrasound of his unborn child, the fetus, to look at the heart. Why? Because he had been told by two doctors in Israel that they should abort the baby. Why? Because the baby has such a horrendous defect in the heart, the baby will not survive. So I was on my way to America at the time he made this call. It was a few weeks ago. I said, send it to my office in America. So he sends the disc with the study. It arrives in my office cracked. I couldn't look at it. So he calls me up. He wants to know, what did I think? Should we, what, are they crazy? What should I do? I said, did you send it to anyone else? So he said, yes. He sent it to a very good person in Philadelphia and another really good person in Boston. And I knew them both. And I said, oh, you're in good hands. Don't bother sending me another one. What, you can go by them. They are expert at reading these things. So what did they say? Just like the Israeli doctors, they said, this is horrendous. It probably won't make it to delivery. Abort. They always love to say that. Abort. Right? It's no good. It's not going to happen. So he tells me this. And I said, wait. Just wait. I said, most things, almost everything we can take care of. Don't think abortion. We're going to get through this. And I arranged for him that he should have surgery at the place I thought, I'm not going to mention any names now, that would be the best hospital in the world to take care of him. Not in Israel. It was in the United States. And that was the last I spoke to him. For a short while after, I was back here already, I get a call. He says, I have a disc to show you. And I forgot when the due date was and what was going on. The baby was born. I go, the baby was born? Where are you? I go, aren't you in X city in the United States? He says, no. I'm in one of the hospitals here in Israel. I go, you are? I'm thinking he's crazy. Based on the reading that they all said, how could he be stupid enough to do this? He says, just read the disc. So this time it came not broken. Came to me. I read it. I call him up and I'm like in shock. I go, you got to send me that other disc. This doesn't look too bad. It looks pretty good. This baby's not going to need any surgery. This baby's going to be fine. He starts crying. I go, what's going on? Reb Chaim was right. I go, who? Where did Reb Chaim come into this? The reason he had gone back to Israel and not listened to me and gone to this United States to have this baby because Reb Chaim, when he was told this whole story, and the four doctors, and he brought in the four doctors' letters saying, this is going to be horrible, this is going to be terrible, this is going to be the end of everything, abort, abort, abort. Reb Chaim said, Now, I usually laugh at those stories, but I'm telling you, I'm eyewitness to this one. What can you say? Every now and then, when I get a little arrogant to think, life's all about just what I could touch and feel and rationalize, I get these reminders from Hashem, don't be a guidebook. Be anav and be humble to realize that life is much more complex. And there's mystery, and there's things that we just don't understand. There's Ruach HaKodesh, there's all sorts of things. So that's a nice story. If anyone wants any more, you can go to Rabbi Shmuel. He has a whole book full of these kind of stories. But, in truth, the real truth is that if we want to really assess life, and this is where we differ so much from the secular philosopher, we know that we have to look to our Nevuas Moshe, the Torah Kedosha, and the Torah is going to tell us about life in a way that it is now fair to assess its meaning and value. So what does the Torah tell us? So the Torah tells us, first and foremost, fundamentally, we're not just a goof. There's more to a person. A person's not just a goof. It's not just a biological entity that's formed from DNA. There's something bigger than the goof. The real you. The real me. It's called the neshama. And the neshama is not tangible. It's not really subject to scientific experimentation, is it? Although I should tell you, there are very fascinating scientific experiments related to proving the presence of the neshama. I don't want to mention a lot of them. I'll just mention two to give a little chizuk to everybody, in case you still need that, if people have that rational side. So there is the famous Dr. Penfield experiments, where he showed he was a neurosurgeon, having somebody's skull open, and he would stimulate Podesta. If anyone's interested, Podesta actually talks about this experiment, but it's very known in the scientific community as well. He would put in an electrode and excite the part of the brain that moves your arm or your leg, and he would have it do it to the patient and ask the patient, what's happening? And the patient would say, you're moving my arm. Not he's moving his arm. You're moving my leg. You're conjuring up memories in me. Scary. I'm seeing vividly memories just from what the doctor was doing. What does that tell me? What does that mean? It means that there's a brain and it's a kli, and there's something separate from it. There's something separate that works with it, called the neshama. In Sichas Musar, Shmuel Levitz tells us, right, this is very famous. If anyone who's been to a Sham Zacha undoubtedly has heard this Gemara. This fantastic neshama, Sofa Umami, Sofa Olam Bat Sofa, Beken Yodehu Kol HaTorah Kula, Lo Amel V'Yageya, Kol Sisrei Habriya Gluyim Lefanav, right? The neshama, our neshamos, when we're in utero, are the amazing Chelek Elokai Mima. The neshama knows everything. The neshama is unbelievable. The neshama, the real you, who you are, is just unstoppable. It's unbelievable. So why aren't we that way now? So Shmuel Levitz continues, famous medrash, everybody's heard it, right? The malach hits you on the lip, you forget Kol HaTorah Kula, right? That's, you know what that means? You know what the real life translation of that is? You're born with your neshama in a guf. And when your neshama is put into a body, right, it now is limited. It doesn't have kol Torah klula. Why did it have to be that way? Why was it meant to be that way? So, many stories, right, and this is what's really emphasized there, Shalom Zachar, right, because Torah is going to be through effort, right? We all know that, right? We're not going to have it the easy way. There are many stories of Dolim that were offered by these Magidim. We'll give you the penis of Torah completely. No, I don't want it. I don't want it. I want to be a Geth. So that's very important. And Talmud Torah and the reacquisition is one of the meanings of life in and of itself. But Rav Dessler takes this notion one step further that I think really answers up all the questions of the meaning of life. And it answers up the question that this young man was asking. And he says, basically, what you have to realize is your brain is a kli that your neshama uses. And every other part of your body is a kli. And some people are born with a kli that's this good, and some people are born with a kli that's this good, and some people are born with a kli that's completely defective and not that good. But the neshama is tahor, and the neshama is great, but it was just placed into this kli. I remember when I was in Camp Hask as a counselor, I asked someone at that time, I said, why did Hashem, I was about your age, right? I said, why did Hashem create these handicapped people? Why? So he gives me a classic answer. He says, for you to achieve, for you, you do chesed, and you can be great. And I hated that answer. So that's the answer. That's it. So their lives, independently, are valueless. There's nothing to them. Can't be. So I would maintain the Phineas Nighty, he's wrong. A better answer to that question is, they have the same neshama tahora that I do, like that song. You're no different, you know that A.B. Rothenberg song? It's so true. They're no different than me. They just have a harder challenge, a harder kli to work with. And maybe their expectations are less. I don't know, that's Hashem's cheshbonos. But the fact is, every human being is a neshama at its core. And we're given a challenge. And the meaning of life is to take the kli you were given and optimize, make the most out of it. I want to tell you a personal story about, I debated to do this or not, but I want to do this. And I hope one day he hears me say this. My father-in-law, he should live and be well. Amazing, amazing person. My kids call him Haya. I'm going to use that name, Haya. Why was he called Haya? Because when he used to come in and greet them, he would go, Haya, and then the name stuck. So we'll all go with it, right? So Haya has lived his life. Really, the focus has been family, and he's very physical, very much loves tinkering. He's like one of those guys that fixes cars. I never learned to do anything because of him, right? I don't know how to do anything in the house, anything with a car, because he always would run over. He had to do it. And he loved to work with his hands. The challenge of a kli to a neshama doesn't only happen at birth. Because unfortunately, over the past 5 to 6 years, he has been stricken with a horrible degenerative neurological disorder that completely makes him unable to do everything that was important to him. He can't use his hands. He's cognitively fine, Baruch Hashem, but he just can't do the things he always loved to do. And I was waiting for the depression, waiting for the despondency. When's he gonna lose it? And never. His neshama was given this challenge, and I have to say, I am so proud of the way he's handled it. I use him as a role model for my children all the time. I say, look at Haya. Nobody's challenged more than him, but look at him. Never complains. He's constantly happy. He's constantly looking to do all the things he always did. And for that, it's such a schus. He has achieved greatness. The challenge that was given to his neshama, and any challenge given to anyone's neshama, is an opportunity for greatness. It's an opportunity that we should have tremendous hakaras hatov for, that we're given it. I could think of two boys that come to my mind in the last 3 years here at Torah Shraga that I felt the same way about them. Unbelievable challenge there in the Shabbos were given. You wouldn't know it from talking to them. I think they are achieving incredible greatness every day of their lives. seems obvious that the meaning of life is for every neshama to realize the universe exists with all its challenges, your body exists with its challenges, and your meaning will be in optimizing your challenge and making the most use of every challenge that comes your way. No question about it. And it's something that deserves a lot of Ikaras HaTorah. I just want to end with fitting this into something that we said before that we haven't really touched upon, and I will end with this. The Korban Todah, all the Korbanos are batal, but the Korban Todah is going to still be there. Why? So, Rav Moshe Tzvi-Neria has a beautiful thing to say about this. He says, it says, Ki sizbechu zevach todah la'Hashem, lirtzonchem tizbach. The Korban Todah, dafka lirtzonchem. The Korban Todah is a Korban that has to be miritzono v'havanoso, it has to be something, like we said before, like the Birchas Agomen, which is patterned after the Korban Todah. It has to be something that comes from a spontaneous, sincere, simchas alev, a hakaras hatov that you feel. He writes, Hasiba lekach hi shehoda shlema beratzon shalom, Shalem, who liros is kolatov hagoloi v'hanista, her achshav v'atid. What's the key to really having a hakaras hatov? Somebody will have a hakaras hatov when they have the fullest and most complete perspective on what life's all about. The yemos Mashiach, the yemos of the geula, when all the secrets are going to be opened, and we're going to really sense why all these things made sense, whatever happened historically, everything's going to be begilot. Is going to be the time when the greatest perspective for a human being to appreciate all that is hidden and all that is revealed and how much all of it is something to be tremendously grateful for. So, the opportunity for these challenges to make us stronger, wiser, better, more compassionate, all the great midos. So that's the meaning of life. And that's the great task each and every one of us has, every neshama has. It's an ultimately a great source for a feeling of shevach v'hodaya. We should all be zocha to have that on a daily basis and really have a very happy, happy daily Thanksgiving. Thank you.